Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. This week, I'm joined by Louise Johnson. Louise is a consultant psychiatrist and clinical lead in the Eden Unit, a regional unit for eating disorders in Aberdeen. Louise has a dual specialisation in medical psychotherapy and child and adolescent psychiatry, along with additional training in various therapy modalities. Louise chairs a national working group focused on managing comorbid personality disorders and eating disorders in Scotland and is involved in eating disorder training and accreditation system as an EEATS supervisor. Louise's passion for creative therapies, influenced by her love for music and creation, drives her efforts to contribute to advancing the evidence base in this area. In this episode, we discuss Louise's role as a consultant psychiatrist and how she supports patients with their medication and other things such as the Mental Health Act that may be required for patients. We also talk about the role of creative therapies in eating disorder recovery and how we can incorporate that more into eating disorder recovery to help people gain coping mechanisms for the future, but also to tap into things that may be too difficult to say out loud. It's so lovely to have you, Louise. It feels like ages since we spoke with, David?
Oh my God, his name. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, as I said, that was like, I can't remember his name now, but it was David. That's good. Yeah. But it's so nice to see you again.
It's lovely to speak to you and see you online as well, Hannah. Yeah.
Still so many of the times you're like, well, yep, yeah, it's nice to meet you, but just online, not in person.
Yeah, so we're still in that world, but yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So for the listeners, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Louise Johnston. I'm a consultant psychiatrist. I work in Aberdeen in the north of Scotland. I'm the consultant and the clinical lead for the Eden Unit. The Eden Unit is a 10-bed inpatient eating disorders unit, and we cover the north of Scotland. So Grampian, Tayside and Highland, and we take patients or adult patients, so over 18s. I've worked there for probably about more than 5 years actually. I've been a consultant there for about 5 years, but I did some training there as well. So and yeah, we've got a great team, and yeah, I enjoy my job and yeah, enjoy the challenges.
And I'm sure we will get on to those challenges in a bit, but just for the listeners, I mean, people might know, they might not know, can you just kind of explain what a consultant psychiatrist does?
Yeah, of course. So I did a medical degree, did a medical training at the University of Aberdeen, and then went on to qualify as a psychiatrist. So did a number of years of training in different specialties. I guess the beauty of psychiatry is that there's a lot of variety. I started by being a child and adolescent trainee and a medical psychotherapy trainee. So I did both, which is a bit of an unusual career path. But I've always been interested in psychotherapy and using talking therapies to try and help my patients. So that's kind of how I started. I ended up working in eating disorders through a colleague and mentor, I suppose, Dr. Morris, Jane Morris, who really helped me to develop my interest. I work in the unit where we admit patients who've got eating disorders or a variety of different eating disorders. And we work with them in collaboration with the outpatient teams to try and put them on a better journey and help them to get more towards recovery or to stabilisation or whatever is right for them.
Mm-hmm. And what does your role entail for that kind of recovery journey and that stabilisation?
So I'm one of the medics on the ward, and I would be the consultant sort of supervising the treatment pathway. So I would be, I guess, leading the team, and helping to decide what the right treatment approaches would be. Together with my other colleague, medical colleague on the unit, we would decide about medication. We would monitor any sort of physical complications. I would be liaising with the doctors in the general medical wards in case there's any sort of physical health issues that we need to deal with. But I guess also things like liaising with the therapists on the unit, helping to decide what the right therapies are, helping to kind of think with the team about formulation, so not just diagnosis but a kind of more holistic kind of approach to thinking about what's right for a particular patient. And then I guess, as we go along, reviewing how the patient's getting on and then thinking about, what's the right trajectory for them in terms of outpatient treatment or discharge. And I guess the other side of it, which I guess is a bit more difficult, is around the Mental Health Act. So if that's needed as part of the treatment journey, then I would be the responsible medical officer. I guess Scottish law is a wee bit different to English law, it's a different terminology, but that would be my role, would be kind of overseeing the Mental Health Act aspects to treatment.
It's interesting that you bring that up, actually, because a couple of weeks ago I did a podcast with somebody whose daughter is an inpatient, and so she's currently being restrained under the Mental Health Act, and I think it'd be interesting if it's okay with you to maybe just talk a little bit more about that, to get a clinician's perspective rather than somebody that's kind of going through it. And I guess just from your perspective, when you're working with eating disorder patients, what is it that sort of brings you to, I'm sure it's very varied for different people, but what brings you to that kind of conclusion that the Mental Health Act is something that's required?
So I suppose, and I can only speak to the Scottish Act because I've never worked in England, so I don't know what the English Act really, I believe it's fairly similar, but there are very sort of very set criteria that govern our use of the Mental Health Act. The Act is really there to protect patients as much as it is to guide treatment and to make sure that patients get the right treatment. And so I suppose what we would be looking for, would be primarily whether patients, because of their illness, are able to make safe and healthy decisions about their treatment. And if we feel that their illness is impacting on their decision making, then we would be able to use the Mental Health Act to compel them to have that treatment or to be in hospital. So it's about protecting patients, from the illness primarily, but also what we're trying to do is make sure that they get the best care as well, because that one of the guiding principles of the Act is that, that as well as us being able to compel them to have the treatment, then we have to be able to provide them with the right treatment as well, and the best treatment that we possibly can. So the criteria are very set, so it's not really a kind of subjective opinion. It's more that there are set criteria, and one of the important things about the Act is that there is the right of appeal and the right to have advocacy and to have legal representation as well, so that obviously I would have my opinion and I would be presenting that as being important, but the patient also has, and their next of kin or named person would have the right to say that too. But I think ultimately the thing with the Act is it's about working in the patient's best interests and trying to make sure that they get care and that they're not disadvantaged by having an illness that affects their judgment.
Yeah. And so what sort of thing, because the person that I had on the podcast before, the reason there, or part of the reason, I don't know the specifics, was sort of NG tube feeding, and that was the reason they were detained in the Mental Health Act. Are there any other things that are quite common in terms of treatment that would be sort of like, we need to detain under the Mental Health Act in order to get this treatment through?
Obviously I can't speak about specific cases, but I think, nasogastric feeding, although it can be very distressing and it's a difficult thing to think about, it is part of our approach to treatment, which is necessary and life-saving sometimes, but other things might be around medication. Somebody, if we felt that somebody would really benefit from medication, but their illness wasn't allowing them to accept that, that would be one thing. I guess the other things might be around, the first thing that we might come up against would be just admitting somebody to hospital, because if we felt they were, for example, in a particularly unwell physical condition because of an eating disorder, it might be very important for somebody to come into hospital and be, to be kept there, even though their illness was perhaps compelling them to want to leave. We might feel that they were safer in hospital, so we could prevent them from doing further harm to themselves and potentially causing life-threatening consequences. So it's mainly, I guess, around admission to hospital, nasogastric feeding, medication. That those would be the main things.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I don't think we've ever really kind of discussed this aspect of treatment before. So thank you for, and I know this wasn't on our plan, but being so open to talk about it.
Yeah. Again, I'm not a legal expert.
Yeah, another question I wanted to ask was about medication, because I don't think there's that much kind of talk or awareness really around medication for eating disorders. Is there kind of research behind specific types of medication that are best for certain types of eating disorders, or is it kind of just like a broad, I don't really know anything about the kind of implications or benefits of medication for them?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there is some evidence that fairly good evidence for things like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, for certain types of eating disorders. What we would acknowledge is that medication is never going to be the sort of the be-all and end-all of treatment. It's not going to be the only approach. But the guidelines recommend, that you can use those as an adjunct to treatment. We also use some medication that's often used in psychotic illnesses, so sort of newer antipsychotics like olanzapine, for example. There is some evidence that can be helpful to just sometimes, if patients are very overwhelmed by the drive, particularly in something like anorexia, to lose weight, then and the sort of really intrusive ruminative thoughts, a combination of olanzapine and sertraline is something that we would use to try and help that. But I suppose fundamentally it's about trying to help the person to be able to manage themselves, and to and medication is something that can be useful in that. And I think that's a good thing, and there is evidence to support that. But I think it's important that's not seen as the only thing, because there's obviously psychotherapies, there's support in the community, there's the behavioural approaches that we use in the unit as well that are really important.
So would you say that the medication is more of a short-term way to manage things, to make the kind of situation right now easier for somebody? It's not something that you would say to somebody, for example, like antidepressants or like ADHD medication, somebody could be on that for the rest of their life in order to manage their symptoms. Would it be like for eating disorders, it's kind of to get you out of that very low point rather than like being on it forever?
I think it's really variable, Hannah. Sometimes, people are on these medications for a long time, and that seems to be, a good thing for some people. We'd also use medication like antidepressants, if people have other mental health conditions at the same time. So, people get very depressed, and that's, so treatment with an antidepressant, and that could be a longer term treatment. We would always suggest that people don't view these as just very short-term solutions, because obviously what we want is for somebody to get well, or to get as well as they can, and to stay well, and then use the medication to help them to maintain that recovery. So we do have people who are on medication for long periods of time, but we also would have people who might be on different things for shorter periods. I think the important thing is that always just to take the advice of your own doctor, because they know you best.
Yeah. And I think that's really nice, kind of, the message that I'm hearing from you is it's completely on the individual level. For some people, it might be that, medication is something that's needed, maybe short term, maybe long term. For other people, it won't be. And it's really about seeing the individual. whilst we were talking about the Mental Health Act before, there's been a lot of talk about palliative care for eating disorders. And I think it would be really nice to have your perspective on it, on somebody that has experience of the Mental Health Act and things like that, because from somebody that probably knows not really that much, but from my perspective, it would just be kind of the only thing I really do know is that I think that eating disorders, everybody has the opportunity or everybody has the potential to recover. They just need to find the right support for them. And I think palliative care is kind of a difficult one because it's, you know, you said earlier about the Mental Health Act, it's helping somebody when they can't make the right judgment to make the right judgment for themselves about their care. And offering palliative care to me when somebody's in that position seems not maybe the right thing to do. But I just wondered from your perspective if you had any other ideas around palliative care for eating disorders to kind of sway one way or the other.
That's a very difficult question because I think that they think there's a lot of it's an understandably very emotive topic. And I suppose all I would really want to say, I think all I would feel kind of qualified to say is that, you know, I would go into treating every patient with the hope and intention that I would want them to get well. And, you know, I think I would never give up on a patient or think that, you know, that I wouldn't want to offer them the very best of care, you know, at whatever stage in their treatment they are. I know that treatment for every patient is different, and I think we have to really promote individualized care plans for patients. And I think we need to meet patients where they are. I think there's some very difficult decisions around treatment, and I think one of the things that as the Faculty of Eating Disorders is looking at is how we, you know, with collaboration with service users and with carers and clinicians, doctors, you know, all the other sort of multidisciplinary team members, how we can try and find our way through this, because it's a difficult area, and it causes obviously a lot of upset and you know, concern and worry. And I think what we would like to do you know, is to try and provide a little bit of clarity and you know, a space to talk about it kind of calmly and taking into account everybody's opinions and to come up with some kind of you know, guidelines or guidance around that. But I can understand it's a very difficult issue, and I think probably that would be all I would feel really able to say.
Yeah. No, I really appreciate you kind of providing that insight, because I think, like you say, it is a very complex, emotive topic, and it's gonna, you know, for everybody it's gonna be a different story, and I think, you know, the people that are involved in that, it's going to be a very difficult thing to be talking about. But on the topic of sort of individualized treatment and things like that, I know today we were going to talk about creative therapies, so I wondered if you might like to start by maybe just explaining what creative therapy is, because I think when I think of art therapy, I'm just like, well, I'm just going to draw and then I'm expected to be better. And that's not the case at all. Well, that's what I used to think anyway, before I knew more about it.
Yeah. So creative therapies are a range of therapies. And, you know, first of all, I need to just say I'm not a creative therapist. That's not my training. I'm not an expert. I suppose I would say I'm a passionate kind of, I've got a passionate interest in that area of treatment from a very long time, from when I was at school. So, I'm very, very keen to kind of know more about it myself. From my point of view, and apologies to any creative therapists who are listening, if I've got this wrong, but my understanding, and I've worked with a lot of very, very good creative therapists who, you know, in the field of drama, psychodrama, art, psychotherapy, music therapy, and, you know, there's lots of different types of creative therapies. And basically the idea behind them all is around using some kind of creative medium to provide an alternative perspective on whatever the difficulty is. And they're not just using eating disorders, obviously they're used in a range of difficulties. And it's about, I think, you know, as I said, I'm talking therapies are my sort of where my training lies, and I think that, though I believe that those are can be really effective as well, but I think sometimes for patients where you know, talking is too much, or, you know, at that particular point in their journey, they're not able to put into words how they're feeling. They can't, you know, integrate all the aspects of themselves, or they can't verbalize, you know, what it is that they're going through. Then I think sometimes a creative therapy can really just shortcut that, and it can really just provide a really lovely way of containing really intense emotion, allowing people to think about aspects of their personality that are maybe difficult that they can't do in other ways. It can provide sort of very, very basically, you know, there's some evidence around music therapy, for example, in sort of a post-meal setting. So it can help to manage anxiety in that kind of heightened arousal state that people might be in. Can also be useful for, you know, for I think, you know, as I say, other conditions other than eating disorders. There's a strong tradition in anthroposophic medicine of using, you know, movement therapies and light therapies and colors and things. So there's a lot of different types of therapies that can be, I guess, under the creative umbrella.
I think the thing that I always think about when I think of creative therapies is often there's almost like, I mean, I this is what I experienced anyway in my recovery, there'd always almost be this path, and I'd get so far and then there'd be a brick wall. I can't get past the brick wall. And that was like, I couldn't verbalize what was going on, but I found imagery really helped. So like to close my eyes and imagine a scene. And then sometimes I'd go away from the session and I'd draw out that scene and kind of draw what was happening in the scene. And one, I think it, you know, it gives you a hobby. It gives you something to do rather than just thinking about the eating disorder all the time. But it also helps you to visualize what's going on and maybe what is motivating you or what's getting in the way. But the other thing I like about it as well is, you know, many people that have anorexia are very perfectionistic. And I found, you know, at the start, I would sit there and I'd be like, well, I don't want to put anything down because what if it's not perfect? And then the more and more you do it, you come back to the paper and you're like, if it just doesn't have to be perfect, then this is about getting down onto paper or, you know, out into music or whatever, how I'm feeling right now, which I think has helped quite a lot with the eating disorder symptoms.
Yeah, Glad to hear you say that, Hannah, because I think it's a universal kind of, perhaps not universal, but a lot of people find that. I mean, music is my outside of work hobby, and you know, but it's more than that for me. And, you know, I've found, you know, that music's been a way of helping when I've had difficult times of my own. And I think a lot of people would feel similarly about painting or drawing or dancing or, you know, doing whatever, you know, sort of creative thing that they might be interested in. I think specific to eating disorders, what the creative therapies that we use are, they provide a bit more of a structured way of doing that, a safe way of doing that, so that we're using it in a way that's not going to do any harm. You know, it's not going to be triggering. It's, and as you say about the perfectionism, I think that's a really good point. A lot of people will say, you know, we have a music therapist and an art psychotherapist on the unit, which is absolutely brilliant, and you know, one of the things that patients will often say is, you know, I can't do art, I can't draw, I'm not musical at all, so why would I want to do that? But I think actually the people who really benefit from it that are often the ones who don't have a skill in that particular area, because they can use it in a very free way and they're not expected to create some kind of masterpiece. It's about expression and, you know, being able to you know, use the process of art making or music to explore rather than to, you know, it's not about the finished object really.
Yeah, I think I really like that exploration thing. And another thing is, it's often an expression of yourself, like you were saying. One of my friends, she's just started dancing, and oh my god, the dances that she sends me, like, she is fully like expressing herself and having a fantastic time. And it's really helped her to come in tune with her body, because she's like, look at what my body can do and the way that I can perform, rather than like what my body looks like or how much weight I've lost and things like that. So it's, I think it's really nice in that sense that there's such a broad range of things that you can be creative with. It's not just kind of putting pen to paper.
I think that's right. And, you know, I think in relation to dance therapy, again, that's something that I really know very little about, but I have met dance therapists mm. who work in the field. And I think it's about doing it in a safe way so that it doesn't become a part of the,
yeah.
the illness and the expression. And as you say, focusing on the positive aspects of it are you know, the mm. the real, you know, medium that's being used. And I think, you know, the evidence is good for these things, very, you know, in very small numbers and very kind of, you know, not in the way that we can use in our guidelines or we can recommend particularly, mm. but, you know, there is evidence that people find it helpful. And, you know, certainly in, you know, in my own, you know, in our own experience, you know, I've seen really, you know, that it's often a nice kind of starting point for people who are perhaps mm. very unwell and can't really think, you know, clearly enough to be doing a talking therapy. They can perhaps engage with a creative therapy, which then allows them to build up a rapport and an engagement and allows them to explore a little bit. And then later on, they might, in conjunction with the continuing therapy, they might want to explore that bit more verbally. You know, so all that integration and exploration of their identity and, you know, all of those things can be put to use in other, I guess, more well-recognized, well-evidenced treatments. So, you know, I guess one of the things I would really like to see is more research and evidence around these mm-hmm. therapies, because then I think we would be able to fund them better, we'd be able to recommend them more, you know, confidently with, you know, proper sort of in a proper evidence base.
How do you think we get to a point where things like that are happening, where more research is being put into a wider range? Because, you know, we mentioned it before, I think the really important thing about eating disorder treatment is making sure that it's individualised and really thinking mm-hmm. about the individual and what suits them. But that's then hard when you've got guidelines that kind of say, if person A has X eating disorder, this is what treatment they should get, rather mm-hmm. than maybe looking at their symptoms or the actual person themselves that and the things that will work best for them.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I suppose it's hard for me to say, as a, you know, as a non creative therapist, where the sort of specific directions for research could go. I mean, I haven't talked to the therapists that I work with. You know, I think it has to start with small projects that then you know, generate a bit more interest, and perhaps, you know, it's about how we get funding to do bigger projects, and that's, I guess, a more difficult issue in the current sort of financial climate. But, you know, I do believe that, you know, passionate, interested individuals will always kind of find ways to mm-hmm. to do these kind of projects, and there are papers written and people doing work in this area, so mm. I suppose it is just about, as well, clinicians being open to thinking in those ways and thinking that maybe, you know, just because something doesn't have a sort of a very, you know, big evidence base, as long as you're, you know, working with sort of accredited, well supervised, you know, properly trained and you know, embedded therapists who can you know, work within a team, for example, or work within the sort of, you know, so that there's an overview of the patient's journey and make sure that things are being done safely. Then I think, you know, open minded treatment in these kind of things is happening. You know, you can see that. Mm-hmm. And art and music yeah. therapists are part of different teams, you know, I've come mm-hmm. across quite a lot who are, you know, throughout the country. So it's definitely there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from your perspective, because obviously you're not trained as a creative therapist, how did you bring more creativity into your practice? I'm just thinking, if people are listening and like, well, I don't have training and I don't have the funding for training, like, what could people do to bring it into their practice so that it is something they can offer?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, I suppose we were lucky in that we had an art psychotherapist in the team right from before I joined the Eden unit, and we've got a relatively new art psychotherapist over the last few years, so you know, I suppose working with existing professionals and developing mm-hmm. links, and if you don't have one within your team, then maybe finding out where the accredited therapists are in your area and trying to make links. The music psychotherapy was a bit more tricky because we didn't have a post on the unit. We managed to secure some funding and we got a pilot project underway with a music therapist, and so that's being done as a sort of ongoing pilot project, and that took quite a lot of work really to get the money and to get all the sort of the permissions and the you know structures in place to allow that to be done safely and with a good sort of governance structure on the ward and things. But it's been great and it's really rewarding. And I suppose, you know, because music is something that I'm really interested in, you know, it's been really nice to be involved with that. And even before before she started, myself and the art psychotherapist ran a group to you know draw together music and art therapy with some of our patients, and that was really well received as well. But you know, I think there's always ways of bringing in creativity, even if it's just you know allowing patients to talk about songs that they like and thinking about what the lyrics might mean to them, or helping people to think about what it is that makes them feel better, encouraging them perhaps to have a playlist for after meals that might help them to feel more relaxed, or you know, musical biographies have been something that we've used quite a bit with the music therapist in the unit. And obviously, you know, our art is such a personal thing too. So you know, it's about you know what might they find helpful, even just talking about that with them, I think, can be really, really helpful. Just keeping that creativity alive in people's minds.
Yeah, I think we often forget how much of an impact. I mean, for me, like music has such a massive impact. It's very emotive for me, and I have a recovery playlist that I'll play, you know, for motivation. And then sometimes I've got one for motivation and another for like if things are a bit difficult. But also, I have it's funny, but if you've watched Finding Nemo, the like opening track to Finding Nemo is so relaxing. And when I was a kid, we had a marine fish tank in our kitchen, and we had like Nemo, we had Dory, we had Bubbles. And so it's been a big thing in my family. So if I'm ever very anxious about something, I'll just put my headphones in and play the Finding Nemo soundtrack. And unfortunately, it's only like 45 seconds long, so sometimes I have to play it a few times, but it's enough to kind of like ground me in the moment and then kind of, you know, just think about my family. And I think things like that, you maybe don't realize how much of an impact they can have to just take you back to that memory, or to just bring you back into the moment and really help you to then think, okay, what is it that I am struggling with now, and what do I need to do in order to support myself?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And there's good, you know, neuroscience and physiological evidence to back that up, you know, that different types of music, different speeds of music can, you know, affect your blood pressure, your pulse. You know, they can make you feel physiologically different. So, you know, there's a very sound rationale to why we find music particularly helpful, or you know, or equally unhelpful. If you're needing something particularly to get you in a frame of mind. So it can be a really powerful thing. And I think also it's a very humanizing thing, isn't it, that you know, finding the common ground with our patients to, you know, the things that we share, because then, you know, it helps us to come alongside people rather than feel that we're you know, we're very different and we're on different sides of the divide, as it were. You know, if we've got music that we can think about, or you know, art or drama or you know whatever it is, there's common ground there. I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, I like that actually, because you know, if I ever hear, because I love my music, I think it's a big part of me. And if someone ever says like, oh, I like X artist, I'm like, we're friends. I don't care anything else about you. Like, I want to be your friend because you like that music. So I think that's a really nice thing, isn't it? A way to build rapport with patients, or a way to build rapport with your therapist or anything like that. Kind of having that common ground around music. I just wanted to think in terms of, if there's any challenges you've come across in terms of creative therapies that, you know, if people are listening, they might be, oh, yeah, I tried it, but this happened, and anything that you've noticed, and maybe any advice that you've had for people listening.
Yeah, I mean, I think like any therapy, I think we sometimes think that psychotherapies of any kind are side effect free, or they're, you know, every therapy's right for everybody. And I think, you know, selection of the right therapy for the right person is a really important part of the assessment that we do. Mm-hmm. You know, in much the same way that you wouldn't want to be given the wrong medication, you know, you wouldn't want to be given the wrong mm-hmm. kind of therapy. So I think, you know, being guided by an individual assessment is really important, you know, and to make sure that it's at the right time as well. So, you know, that it may not be appropriate for somebody to have a creative therapy and you know, mm-hmm. it'd be important that for that, you know, to kind of understand that so that it doesn't feel like it's a prejudice or it's a, you know, it's unfair or whatever. There might be very good kind of clinical reasons why it's not the right time for somebody. I mean, that being said, there, you know, there are challenges. It might, you know, certain things might be very triggering for people. So, you know, again, it might be really important to have the right, it would be really important to have the right therapist who's qualified and able to deal with those kind of situations. You know, might strong emotions might come to the surface that you might not be aware of. And, you know, you need to be somebody who could kind of help the person to manage that, I think is really important. You know, I guess you know, like, timing is really, really important. I think making sure that it is the right time for somebody. I think other things, you know, might come into play. Like we mentioned, dance therapy earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we would have to be really careful around, you know, when is the right time for somebody to be moving and expending energy. You know, particularly yeah. something like anorexia, and you know, that's something that we were worried about. So, you know, again, it's a clinical sort of judgment, but you know, qualified therapist would be able to make those kind of judgment calls. And. And that's why we work in a team, so we can all kind of have mm-hmm. that approach together and think about it.
Yeah. And I suppose that's where it's so nice that creative therapies are so broad, because if somebody is in a position where maybe dance isn't appropriate right now, it could be that, you know, something creative in another sense, maybe drawing or painting or mm-hmm. music, things like that might be right. And sometimes I think another thing that's really nice about creative therapies is it really helps you not only to kind of process what's going on with you right now and maybe to work through things that you're stuck on, but really to think about the future as well, you know, to get really creative. And, you know, I have so many things around my house that I've created myself, mm-hmm. one to kind of, you know, distract me in the moment, but also to motivate me for the future. And like, I know my friends have like bracelets and I've really got into jewellery making and mm-hmm. things like that. And it's then something, you know, a really nice hobby for you mm-hmm. to have as well, that can distract you when those thoughts get really loud. And you know, I know from experience that often that is very difficult mm-hmm. because the thoughts are very loud and mm-hmm. the, you know, thing distractions often kind of don't meet that. But I do think it's something really nice to kind of feel good about as well, and mm-hmm. just feel inspired when you're creating something.
That's right. I mean, I suppose it's about both, really, isn't it? Because, you know, we also have very, you know, wonderful OT colleagues in the team who would do the mm. sort of more distraction and, you know, vocational side of things. And, you know, mm-hmm. I think that the aims of that kind of treatment are quite different. And I suppose it would be quite important to make sure that, you know, for a more exploratory psychotherapy, that might be something that you wouldn't really want to be doing kind of on your own at yeah. home, or, you know, without supervision from somebody who could kind mm. of help you. Because I think, you know, having been in experiential groups myself as part of my training, I the thing that really struck me was in an experiential art psychotherapy group, and, you know, the thing that really struck me was that no matter how you try to sort of defend yourself and not give away too much or not tap into kind of mm. unconscious processes, I think what happens is that just does tend to happen, and you know, you can very quickly find yourself you know, expressing things that perhaps if you're not with somebody who's qualified to deal with that might be quite difficult. So I think that's a mm. really, really important thing as well. But yes, you know, all of those things, jewelry making and you know, other crafts are a wonderful way of managing mm. some of the distress around the eating disorder as well. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, Louise, it's been so nice to chat to you, and I feel like we had such a good blend there of, you know, talking about creative therapies but then also talking about your role as a psychiatrist, which is so interesting, because I think often that's something that we don't maybe get to discuss as much on the podcast. So thank you so much for sharing your insights on that, and thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It's been lovely to talk to you, Hannah. Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.